This is Beverage Barons. Today on Beverage Barons, Bill Oliver and the Oliver Winery. We learn how a law professor's hobby became a 400,000 case enterprise, why Bill Oliver doesn't need a cold winter to make ice wine, and why Oliver repackaged his mead, one of the winery's first successful products. And a bonus, Bill Oliver's worst decision. And here we go.
So good afternoon, everybody. This is Joel Whitaker, the editor of Cane's Beverage News Daily, and we're talking with Bill Oliver of Oliver Winery, which has the great distinction of being the oldest and I believe largest winery in the state of Indiana.
We are indeed.
Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing great today. And you?
Excellent. Thank you. So they recently released relaunched, their mead product. So let's start with that, Bill. Tell us a little bit about the mead product and why you repackaged it and all that good stuff. And we'll go from there to the story of the winery and a broader.
Sure. Well, we've been making mead for a good long time. You know, my father started the winery in 1972, and I believe mead came on the scene about 1974. So, you know, an early product for us. And the first thing that really ever achieved any, you know, volume for us, and I think kind of its heyday back in around 1980 or so, and maybe 15,000 cases a year of Camelot mead for us was the majority of our product. And as we diversified into other products, you know, that, you know, the focus kind of shifted away from that. And we still produce a little bit south of 10,000 cases a year of it. But so it's an important wine for us, but although not as a part of the overall picture, not that big. But, you know, I think we're on batch number 685 right now. So we've got a lot of experience under our belts. And, you know, I'd like to say that we were making mead before it was cool. I mean, there's a lot of meaderies that have popped up and really sort of adopted sort of that, you know, that craft beverage sort of model. And we've been watching that. And all the time we're thinking, gee, we've been making this thing for a long time. And we're tasting these other meads. And honestly, felt ours was better. I mean, really better. A lot of the other guys were getting, like, big prices, you know, in our mind. We're like, wow, $20 for a bottle of mead. And how can we get a little of that business? And So just in an effort to kind of relaunch and reinvigorate and say, hey, yeah, we make mead too, we came out with a kind of edgy sort of look. I would call it sort of an Alice in Wonderland sort of fantasy sort of label. Super excited about it. I think it really kind of puts it right back where it belongs, to sort of in the craft category. And, you know, we make it with orange blossom honey. We're really particular about that. We've been through all the mixes, all the wildflower honeys, clover honey, and all this. And orange blossom is the one that ferments the most predictably and gives us consistent, clean, really floral, very sort of you know, not really overly viscous sort of a mead. You know, it almost seems like it might be like a late harvest Riesling, and I've had people in a blind tasting suggest that it was. Believe it or not. So, you know, a bit less sweet than many of the others out there. Ours runs, around 4% residual sugar. I think many others are in the, you know, 8 or so, pretty viscous sort of wines. And mead has been, it's challenging to make. It's yeast that we use for winemaking are adapted for grape juice. That's their home. That's what they love, and they know what to do with that. When you put them in a honey mixture, they're like, what the heck? There's natural enzymes in honey that inhibit fermentation. And I think probably the biggest thing that we've done is work through the challenges of getting a really clean, healthy fermentation for making mead. And I think that's the biggest challenge I've heard from other mead makers is, how do you get this stuff to ferment? So we've worked through that process.
That sounds like it could well indeed be a process. Now, you don't grow the honey yourself. I mean, you don't have a beehive out back, do you?
No, we don't. I'm kind of intrigued by it. I mean, I think the notion of keeping bees is pretty romantic, but I've got a lot of hobbies already. But, you know, we get in honey in tanker loads, 44,000 pounds at a time. So about 3 of those a year. So I can't even imagine how many beehives that would take, not to mention the conspicuous lack of orange groves in southern Indiana. So
true.
Yeah, I was talking to our honey supplier, and remarkably, their business is, and what they would say that what they do is they pollinate fruit. They pollinate orange groves, they pollinate almond groves, and that kind of thing. And as a byproduct, they get honey, which they're fortunate to be able to sell. And they said that they have more revenue from pollination services than from selling honey.
That's interesting. In
Isn't
itself.
That amazing? I had no idea until he told me that. I was like, that is crazy.
Yeah. But I can see how that would be a valuable service for a citrus grower.
Yeah, we all win on that deal, don't we?
Exactly.
For sure.
Yeah. Now, the winery started, you said, back in 1972. Your dad was an Indiana University law professor, right?
Right.
And what led him into this crazy business?
Well, he had a lot of hobbies. I mean, he just tinkered with everything. He was a home winemaker. My early memories of time with my father were helping him in the basement of our home as a 5 to 6 year old. I mean, literally stomping grapes with neighborhood kids and little vats with grapes in them. And, that's just the kind of those, we all have these earliest memories of great times with our family, and that was for sure mine. In 1966, we traveled to Cornell in Ithaca, New York, as a family, to where he had a year-long sabbatical leave to teach law at Cornell, and he became really intrigued with the Finger Lakes wineries and their reemergence, and thought, heck, if they can grow grapes to make wine in the Finger Lakes area, why not Southern Indiana? So he came back and planted grapes shortly thereafter, and it was during the early 70s, about 71, where he approached the Indiana Alcoholic Beverage Commission about starting a winery, and they didn't have any license on the books that would really allow us to operate as we think wineries operate today, with tasting rooms and all that. So he got the Indiana Small Winery Act passed shortly thereafter, and we opened in 1972.
Very good. And so, and that story in its own right takes care of all the people who say that college professors don't need sabbaticals because it never leads to anything. We just found out that in this case, at least, it led to him getting involved in a whole new business.
Exactly. Yeah, no doubt.
But he remained a professor for his entire career, right?
Yeah, he was involved in that. And he was in this conundrum that I see a lot of small wineries in, where the owner, the founder, has a full-time job, and the winery's on the side, and the lack of time he has available to spend at the winery sort of ensures the winery will be successful, but he can't afford to leave his job. I mean, it's really a catch-22 that I find these startups in often, and people have asked me, hey, what should I do? And I was like, I really don't know what you should do, because that's like a pretty risky situation. But and when I showed up in 1983, my dad was just delighted that somebody with the last name Oliver showed up on the scene for full time and I was able to grow it just kind of with some basic common sense things. It was just clean the place up and make good wines that are attractively packaged, treat customers nice when they walk in the front door, and that's a real simple business model, but you can apply it to a whole lot of different business enterprises. Met my wife when I got my MBA in 1990 and 1991, and she joined the business, and she's just a really smart administrator in terms of a sit down at a desk, get the HR done, get the marketing done, all that kind of stuff. And I'm much more of a on my feet, more of an operations person, a vineyard and winemaking. And together we have been really quite a team, and have grown it considerably. Last year we were just a hair south of 400,000 cases.
That's a pretty substantial number.
Yeah, it's gotten there for sure. And I show up here in the morning sometimes, and I'm like, what the heck have we done? It's just like, wow. It's good. It's really good.
Yeah. So when your dad started this winery, he was buying grape juice from other people, right?
Well, he was growing grapes. So we started a vineyard in 1966.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right. So we had some of the really old school hybrids that people don't grow much anymore, and it would be that Deschanac, Aurora, Baco Noir, and they certainly grew well here, produced a nice crop, but the wines were not so good. I think really as the hybrid types have developed over the years, and we have new ones like Traminette, Chardonnay, and others that have made just beautiful wines. And so that's kind of what we're looking for when we're in our vineyard, is what works here from a practical viticulture point of view? What will grow here? And then combine with what's going to make nice wine. Just kind of think of it as a Venn diagram of, what it's got to do both things for it. Either of those, deficient either one of those, it's not worth planting. So that's kind of where we are from a grape growing perspective. And we've got 60 acres, which supplies us with, 3, maybe 4% of what we use. And then we buy a heck of a lot from outside, from California, Washington, Michigan, New York, Pennsylvania, apples from Michigan, honey comes from a Michigan supplier.
So it's you just told me something I did not know about you, and I thought I knew the story moderately well, but obviously not, namely that you all were able to grow grapes from the beginning.
Oh yeah, for sure, for sure. Yeah, we had a, you know, I showed up in 1983. Okay, fresh with my bachelor's degree in business, and one of the, just looking at the situation and not profitable, and like, what can we not do? What can we stop doing that's costing us money and not contributing to at least positive cash flow, if not profitability? And grape growing is a thing we stopped doing in 1983. We started again in 1994, so there was a gap there.
So that explains why I thought that.
Yeah, and then so in 94 we started, and we were really excited about some of the new grape varieties that were out there. We were just really fired up, especially about Traminette and Chardonnay. You know, we've really since adopted some of the older ones, like Vignole and Chamberson, we really enjoy. There's some other new, really new ones, too, that are crosses between Vinifera and Norton or Cynthiana. I don't know if you know that grape, but and those are promising, and I consider the vineyard to be sort of an ongoing experiment and what works and what doesn't. And you know, we've had some great successes and some things that, man, that didn't work out, let's take that out. So just an ongoing, you know, and I kind of like that. I kind of like the problem solving and scratching our heads and, you know, how are we going to make this work. So
sure, that makes a lot of sense. And is the vineyard you have now the same one that your dad had back in the day?
Same site, yeah, same site.
Same site.
Yeah, done differently, but yeah, but same site.
What did you do with it when you weren't growing grapes?
Oh, it just went wild. It just went wild. We honestly just didn't go there. You know,
oh, okay.
It was out of sight, out of mind. And it was funny because I was, I met my then girlfriend, now my wife, Kathleen Nossel, back in the MBA program, and I take her out to this place, which had been abandoned for like 8 years, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this, you know, like ghost vineyard, you know, with like the trellis falling over and vines just growing on the ground and all sorts of wild trees and, you know, like be like sycamore and sumac and sassafras trees propping up. I mean, weeds as tall as your forehead.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, how would you like to help me rebuild this? She's about ready to say, yeah, I think I'm going to take that job in California. But, oh, yeah, it was kind of nuts. So, yeah, we learned what happens when you try to mow over vineyard wire that's laying on the ground. It gets all tangled up in your bush hog. But anyway, that was kind of real. That's what we had after leaving it alone for 8 years. But you wouldn't recognize it now. Now it's as manicured as a golf course. So
I've seen pictures. It looks really nice, I got to tell you. It looks just fine.
Beautiful.
So when you started, you were basically just doing business in the state of Indiana. When did you start expanding?
2000.
2000?
Yeah, near year 2000. We just didn't have the capacity, and we had some solid growth in the 90s and some inquiries from outside the state, but we didn't have the capacity to entertain those opportunities. And so we built a big new, just a, you know, very much of a steel building with a tank room and bottling line and warehousing. And opened up Kentucky and Ohio right, you know, in 2000, and then Illinois and Michigan shortly thereafter. And now we're in 20 states, 22 states. I mean, depending on what you count, some states are really small and probably not worth mentioning. But, you know, really focusing on our core, which would be Indiana plus the four contiguous states. Tennessee is really solid. Florida and Texas are getting some pretty nice numbers, too. So that's where we are. Yeah.
So you avoided the temptation to launch your export division within 3 days after you arrived on the scene.
Yeah, you know what? The longer we do this, we find that the fewer things we do, or the fewer wines we make, and selling them in fewer places, the more wine we sell.
Mm-hmm.
Just to really focus geographically and focus on the varieties that really make sense for us, and that's been kind of a discipline that it's been learned, and really, I think in the last 3 or 4 years, really been implemented, just to try to do fewer things better.
Now, did they teach you that in business school? And I presume you went to business school at IU.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I have an IU. Yeah. No, I didn't learn that there. No.
Okay.
I only got my MBA to get a wife. So I got that. Yeah. I'm sure I learned something there, but nothing comes to mind right away.
The Kelly people will not appreciate this interview.
Yeah, we had seven couples come out of our class, out of our class of 350 students.
Right.
Yeah, and we had two divorces, so a net gain of five on the marriages. So
still, that's from what I've seen, the really successful guys often do exactly what you're doing, which is to stay close to home and then expand very slowly as they need to, but they don't seem to be rushing overseas, where some other guys, you know, my comment about 3 days after you arrived on the scene was only slightly sarcastic. There are some people who within a year after they open up announce they're now exporting to Germany or someplace. Which,
you know, that's Tim Cook, you know, chairman of Apple, said something that I thought was really, really smart. He says, we say no to good ideas every day. And that's something you've really got to learn to do, is to say, yeah, that's a great idea, but it's just not what we're doing now.
Right.
You know, that's going to take resources away from the really important tasks that we've defined for this week or next year, and we'll think about it for another time. But right now, we've really got our priorities. And by imposing that kind of discipline, it's been great for the organization. Not only is it just lets the employees know why we're here, what we're doing, what's the mission. You can't have 19 priorities. You can have three,
right?
Four. So that's been very helpful for us.
How big an organization have you got now?
105 employees.
105, so and you're doing about 400,000 gallons.
400,000 cases.
A year. That's a pretty good number. You have any immediate expansion plans?
We're working on it right now, absolutely. We grew 16% last year, so I am just overseeing the completion of an outdoor, I call it a small tank farm, 314,000-gallon tanks, and working with architects on a new production building that will break ground on soon. I'm not sure exactly when. It's going to be really dependent on how sales hold up, and we don't want to have it certainly no later than we need it, but not long before we need it. Just trying to, you know, pay for things as we go here.
Yeah. You're not a big fan of going to the bank, huh?
No, we have no bank debt now. And
congratulations.
I tell you, I talk about sleeping better. Big time.
I got all choked up there at the thought of no bank debt.
I gotta say, the day we did that, I was just like, you know, we didn't have any big celebration, but it was probably a cause for one.
Yeah, it probably was. We should have arranged for you to get a bottle of champagne from
somebody. Right.
I guess I should be politically correct and say sparkling wine.
Yeah, well, it could be champagne. It could be from France. Who knows?
Yeah.
We make sparkling wine, by the way.
Yeah. Do you, what do you make it out of?
That's a Creek Bend wine, so that means it's all our estate stuff. All our estate wines are from Creek Bend, are labeled Creek Bend Vineyard, and we make it out of Vidal Blanc.
Okay.
You probably know that grape. We also do ice wine with Vidal Blanc.
And in some years in Indiana, you can really do ice wine, too.
You know, I mean, here's kind of the interesting reality of our weather here. Well, it's certainly on average warmer here than it would be in Ontario, right, which would be kind of the current sort of epicenter of ice wine making, that we our extremes are more extreme than theirs, right? So our absolute coldest day in the winter is undoubtedly colder than it would be in St. Catharines, Ontario. But it's just volatile. I mean, it could be 40 one day, 10 the next, back up to 60, you know, 10 below zero the next day. So, and if I tell people for ice wine, I don't need a cold winter. I need a cold day. I just need a cold day, one cold day. So, and, you know, with you know, the 10-day weather forecast right on your computer, you know, you're looking at that, and then you're sending an email to your vineyard manager saying, hey, Bernie, did you see the weather forecast for Thursday? And he's way ahead of you. He says, yeah, let's do it. So that's kind of the way it works. So we picked, for ice wine this year, we picked, it was around December 20th, I'm thinking, but it was pretty early for us. And the coldest day of our whole winter, which happened early for us. We started picking it probably a little bit before sunrise, and by when we got done at 10 o'clock in the morning, it still hadn't been reached 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was a good day for it.
So that was a good day. I know that weather extreme in Indiana very well. I remember when I was a student at IU years and years ago, at one point it got so cold that they literally had pipes bursting. Very unusual,
but
that happened. And, you know, they basically shut down classes and told people living off campus, if you need to come on campus, we'll figure a way to take care of you.
Do you know what year that was?
I'm thinking it had to be either in the early 60s or maybe 66. No, it had to be in the early 60s, like 63, I think, maybe.
Sure. Okay. All right.
But it was an experience. And,
No doubt. Yeah, we had another one of those in the winter of, like, it was on early January of 2014. We were in the, like, 26 below zero for about 24 hours, and it was just a disaster for the vineyard. It was just awful. We got to find out, you know, I mean, you understand from the literature what grape varieties are allegedly winter hardy, right? I mean, you know, you can look on these charts and you buy the grapevines, you talk with the growers, but when it gets that cold, you really find out what's winter hardy. I mean, that was, you know.
And now you know, huh?
Now we know, exactly. Yeah, and the whole theory of whether grapevines can be grown from the ground when they died to the ground, well, it works for some varieties. It doesn't work for others.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're still experimenting.
We are. I'm sure there's lessons to be learned that down the road here.
I'm sure that's true too. We talked about how you're risk averse when it comes to expansion. We also talked about how you are planning to expand. You don't have a timetable, I gather, for that per se. I would guess it's within the next 2 years or so, maybe.
Yeah. I'm going to really bore you with this, but we hired a consultant to build this capacity planning model, which we can insert sales projections, and it will kind of, what it does is it just basically tells us where the pinch points are and where we need to invest in. What kind of, do we need more tanks? Do we need faster bottling line? Do we need more people and all these things? So we're kind of using that as a way to figure out to be, you know, maybe a 20 months ahead of, you know, on the capacity, but just trying to be really smart about how we manage our money, manage our assets, manage our balance sheet, basically. So,
sure.
Using that kind of discipline. But I'm hoped that in this basically new winery that we're going to build, it can be done in, I would say it'd be built in 2019 if things continue the way they are. So,
So that's about 2 years away. Not bad for me as a forecaster. And how about people? You got enough people? You need more people?
We do. You know, it's funny because right before this, I got out of a meeting about that. We're talking about kind of the needs of winemaking, just kind of, I mean, you know, for special roles, and particularly a person with a legitimate kind of, you know, winemaker title. You know, I think we're probably at the point where we can use, you know, two people carrying the winemaker card around here and sort of share the responsibilities and sort of chasing down opportunities for improvement.
Sure.
Yeah.
How about your distributors? You happy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we're fine with them. You know, I know there's a lot of, you know, it could be some grumbling out there about the three-tier system and all that, but, you know, it's worked really well for us. And I think we've gotten past kind of the volume level where it's hard to make it work, and I think we're well into that, you know, kind of that orbit now where the distributors value us and we value them. So it's working well.
Yeah, there is a point where it doesn't work, and there's a point where it definitely does work. And I've heard different numbers. The number I've usually heard is around 25,000 cases, but my guess is for it really to be a really good deal, it's probably a little bit higher. But
I would think it's higher. I would think it'd be up in the close to 100. But
yeah,
but I think there's just an awkward place to be where, you know, if you're small and you're selling off the front door, that's great. If you're large and you're thinking of distribution, that's great. But I think there's an awkward sort of a diseconomy of scales thing that happens in that sort of in the 50,000, not quite big enough to be able to sell your wine for half price, which you do essentially when you sell a distributor. You just haven't got the economy scale to pull that off. So somehow we survived getting through that gap. But I guess really I've talked to wineries that have experienced that problem.
How hard was it to get through that gap?
Well, you know, we did it mostly through retail, because we sell about 30,000 cases out the front door. Yeah, which that's important. So I think that we had a substantial retail business kind of going through that almost awkward adolescent stage of distribution sales just sort of made it bearable. We just kind of subsidized it through retail sales, like, more or less.
Yeah, I could see that. And, of course, with the retail side out the front door, you're keeping all the profits. You're not sharing with a distributor or anybody else. So
exactly.
That
can
help you a lot.
Admittedly, yeah, right. But with significant selling costs, too. I mean, because, you know, tasting rooms are not inexpensive to operate. But, yeah, the higher margins are certainly good.
Yeah. And how much of your grape juice you buy from outside your own estate capability?
Oh, over 95%.
95%?
Yeah, right. Because, you know, we're just, you know, a lot of the things that we're making is just like we've gotten scaled up pretty big. You know, we use a lot of apple, you know, cider products. We also use a lot of Lebrescas, Concord, Niagara, Catawba for, you know, these refreshing, sweeter wines, and there's a big market for that. And
sure.
And we're happy to make those wines and do it well, and we've got a loyal following for that. You've probably been on our website. You've seen kind of our take on, I think we well define who we are on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I've been on the website, and, you know, it's, by the way, it's a nice, clean website, which is a real pleasure to work with a little bit. Well, that's great. So you've got your mead label redesigned, and the new package is out. How's it doing?
Good. Really good. You know, because I'll tell you the two things. One is we significantly increased the price.
Uh-huh.
And so, I mean, and that comes with some risk, right? I mean, what's going to happen out there? But we're seeing volume up solidly.
Excellent.
So, oh yeah, I mean, that's kind of that's what we had our fingers crossed for, and that's what's happening. We're getting a lot more attention from places we wouldn't normally have, especially the small, more craft oriented buyers are really interested. It just really has a good look to it. It's working. Yeah, it was a little bit of a roll of the dice, but in a product that wasn't a significant percentage of our overall sales, I think we were willing to take the risk in order to kind of get it to a much better place.
Sure. Well, that's terrific. And let's see, if I asked you to go back to the Kelley School, from which you got your MBA,
sure,
and asked you to give a guest lecture in the entrepreneur program there, what would be the biggest piece of advice you would give, both in terms of the positive side, and then what was the biggest lesson learned that you wish you had never learned?
Oh, that's interesting, because you know what? I go back there regularly and do guest lectures there.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk a lot about kind of organizational change and about building an organization and about hiring the right people and about, you know, just a bit, the whole concept of leadership and what does leadership mean in terms of, like, setting a vision and you know, some of the things I alluded to earlier, really, establishing priorities and all that, getting everybody pulled in the same direction. And then also just kind of brand building, about how, you know, taking care of your brand, making sure that it's you're thoughtfully developing your brand and you're taking care of it in terms of what is your company, what's the image of your company? I mean, what do people think of you and your products? And sort of, you know, managing that process really carefully. And, you know, you find that with all the great businesses. I mean, there's good examples of us all around, you know, Starbucks and Apple and all these, like, iconic brands of the modern world. And I don't pretend to be anything like them, but there certainly are lessons to be learned from them that we've tried to put into place here.
Right.
So, and yeah, organizational development is definitely the top, though.
And how about the negative side? What was the most disappointing episode you had, or the thing that made you think, gee, maybe I shouldn't be doing this? Or
yeah, you know, I tell you, you know, we've had some really bad hires, and just sort of, you know, careless hiring mistakes that we should have known better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, yeah, you know, it's almost one of these people you hire and you go, I don't think it's going to work out. You got something, a gut feel,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you ignore it at your peril, right? So I think
yep.
that's but you can't be so paranoid that you don't hire anybody because you're afraid to make a mistake. So, you know, our ability to hire good people has really, really improved. And then the other thing is you just got to be just really have your be more in touch with your consumer base and what they think of your wines and who they are and what they want. And I'll tell you where this all went south on us was we took our number one selling wine, which was in a cork finish. It's Concord wine. All right,
mm-hmm.
And we decided to put it in a Stelvin, in a screw cap. This was about 5 years ago. All right, we didn't ask anybody. We didn't do any focus groups. We never consulted one customer, and we came out at a very technical kind of winemaker point of view that this is a superior closure, and we'll be able to explain it. And, yeah, some people won't like it, but we'll explain it when we tell them it's better for the wine. Everybody's going to get on board, and everybody's going to be happy, you know, kind of like New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. It was an awful decision, and it bit us really hard.
Oh boy!
Definitely lost some sales, and the interesting thing about it was, you know, for that consumer, you know, I could explain to them what you and I know, the advantages of a screw cap are, what a superior closure it is, and they would all understand it, and they'd still look at me and go, "No, I still want a cork."
Yeah,
they don't care; they want a cork. Darn it! So yeah, so it was a big kind of a, you know, mea culpa kind of a thing for us to go, you win, I'm sorry, here's your cork. So,
and how fast did you backtrack on that?
We 3 years we tried to muddle through the screw cap period of Oliver Winery's existence. Yeah, you know, I mean, so I think that's probably an example of one of the things we've done that was not terribly smart.
Right. Okay.
There's others, but, you know, that stands out.
Well, certainly, you know, I mean, certainly bad hires is one thing, and being out of touch with your consumer base is something that can be just disastrous, which is why I think you're so lucky to have a tasting room and so on, because you can literally see what happens day by day.
I love it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. I can walk in there like this afternoon and go, you know, how are people liking the Chardonnay? And, you know, my staff will tell me.
And they'll tell you. Are people liking the Chardonnay?
You know, we grow a little bit of vinifera at Creek Bend, and the recently released a Chardonnay. It's very classic, very clean, it's sort of medium-bodied. It's really a beautiful wine. And so, yeah, they're really liking it. I was actually just pouring it for some people this morning, limited production.
That's a really good thing. So, Bill, is there anything that you wish I would have asked you that I didn't?
I'm trying to think. You know, we're. I think one of the things that we're really in tune here was kind of just the visitor experience that we provide from a retailing mm-hmm. operation, and you know, music on the weekends on the patio, and you know, 13 acres of landscaping. We've got a full-time landscaping crew here, and so just kind of that, how we've kind of cultivated that visitor experience in a kind of a rich sort of way. And you know, we're not the first winery to do that, but we've done a good job, and we've got a lot more investments to make in that area. We're really excited looking down the road at the potential of what we can do, you know, right here at the winery to sort of you know, build customer loyalty and sort of build a brand.
Sure. Well, Bill, I thank you very much for your time. It's been a delightful interview. I am glad that things are going well. I'm astounded to learn that you actually, at one point, before you had your estate vineyard out there, you had an estate vineyard out there. So
yeah, we did. You know. Yeah, it's kind of a donut and a hole in the middle. But yeah. And that's where I like to spend my time, honestly. You know, when I'm sitting there answering emails, I look out the window and I go, I wish I was on a tractor. You know, sometimes I just go do that.
I can see that as a real possibility, let me tell you.
Yeah, I sure can.
And and that must be a really good experience to be able to take off and do that. Well, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it. We're going to get this up pretty quickly, and you know, really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you and to learn all about your mead product redesign, which is terrific, and about the good success you've had. You've obviously done pretty well so far.
This is Joel Whitaker. Thank you so much for listening to our program on Beverage Barons today, and we hope you will join us again for another one of our interesting interviews with industry experts from the editors of Cane's Beverage News Daily. To see our editorial product, please go to www.bevnewsonline.com, and have a very great day. Goodbye now.